Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 134, where we are discussing Charles Perrow's 1984 book, Normal Accidents, Living with High-Risk Technologies, published by Basic Books and updated in 1999 by Princeton University Press. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Good morning. This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States, where it's freezing cold and snowing.
This is Sam calling from Lisbon, where it's sunny and raining at the same time.
And this is Pedro coming to you from the center of Italy, where it's foggy today.
So we're all enjoying some really wonderful weather this December morning. We're going to cover a very fascinating book, Normal Accidents, Living with High-Risk Technologies by Charles Perrow. This is definitely a break from our recent discussions about organization studies. This is much more of a technical history on some great accidents that had happened in the 1960s through the 1980s. And he has a lot to say about it. Anybody want to introduce us to the book?
Okay, let me try this. So what Perrow is doing here is trying to, as Tom was saying, extract a new view or a new theory about accidents. It's coming from a lot of studies of a variety of industry, but most compellingly and central for the book, the Three Mile Island accident. And the idea here is that unlike much of the popular debate back then and still today, one of the key points that Perrow is trying to advance is that we should not think in terms of component failure and in particular operator error, which is as always and still is one way to think about such problems, but try to move at the system level view. So a normal accident is also understood as a system accident. The idea being that when we have systems or organizations, such as Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, in which we have multiple components that operate in a complex way, which means that each component can have multiple functions, and at the same time, they are tightly coupled. These are two dimensions that he uses to situate and create a map for the variety of industries and production processes. And have a production process that is a continuous flow that cannot be stopped, then he says that we are likely to expect accidents to happen, therefore normal accidents. And to arrive there, of course, it creates a very rich and interesting vocabulary for us to understand what it means to think about safety and risks and accidents at the system level, how we can think about characteristics across different industries and how they are moderating contingent factors by which we see more or less some of this. The one, as he has as the main example, nuclear power plants being the most likely one for many reasons we're going to, I'm sure, get into. And of course, we're going to get at later. This book had a long shadow because it both inaugurated and was part of a discussion about safety and how organizational theory can have a say into that. And somehow is important to put also in the context of the podcast, because there is still an interesting debate about this perspective and others in org theory, some of which we have covered here in the podcast, such as high reliability organization and the whole branch of studies related to Carl Weick. So I think that is just like a first setup, but I think we have much to discuss for sure.
Yeah, thanks, Pedro. And what I'll also say is that he does a very good job of examining several different industries, you know, whole classes of industries, which have basically their high risk of systemic accidents, much like Three Mile Island being representative of the nuclear industry. He examined petrochemicals. He examined airline systems or air systems, which would include airlines and air traffic control, maritime systems, ships and ship accidents. That was the longest chapter. And in the version that I read, and I believe it's also the same version that you had, so it was originally published 1984. We read the 1999 update, and he puts towards the end somewhat of a forward look at emerging technologies, in particular an afterword about what was known as the Y2K problem, which at the time of the revision was an unknown. And I remember the we could talk about it later, but I was there in the computer science industry when Y2K was a big fear. And it turned out not to be much. And it's interesting to see that Perro himself predicted or forecasted that it wasn't going to be that big of a deal in that afterward. So we'll have to, you know, when we look at the theory, we can explain why it was he came to that conclusion.
So maybe to situate the whole story, we can use the anecdotes that Perro starts the book with. Because I must say that I originally read, I think, only that chapter in a class when I was an undergrad and took a class in arc theory. And it was so powerful that it stuck with me, right? And it was interesting to read again and see how he is able to boil a lot of the key idea from the day in the life of a person that is trying to get downtown for a job interview. And many things go wrong. And I think it starts with a coffee pot that breaks, and then leads the person to rush out of the door. And then the person is locked down and try to get to the neighbor to get the person to downtown because the transport is also, public transport is also down that day and they can't get a taxi. So there's like this chain of events that some of them are correlated or coupled in his terms and some are not, that a particular moment come together that leads the person losing the job interview, right? And I think in a way it is so relatable, and I think it's so evocative because he then, of course, uses many of the ideas that he sows the seeds in such anecdotes to then go all the way up to explaining an accident at a nuclear power plant, right? Which, of course, is much, much, much complex. But the components of his idea are already there.
Yes, I think that example really nicely illustrates the phenomena that he's interested in understanding, right? So it's not, when we hear accidents, we might think of like this one thing going wrong or this one person like not understanding what was happening and doing the wrong things or taking the wrong decisions. But he really explains throughout the whole book that a lot of these big accidents that have kind of the highest risk or the bigger implications are really just a series of things failing. Some of them he even calls, right, like these bizarre things that nobody could have predicted. And not only that we cannot predict just by the nature of the type of work that these organizations are doing, but also because of the way the system has been designed, that people are unable to actually understand what is going on as it is going on, right? So that's also why he does a lot of the criticism on this, attributing so many of these accidents to like operator error and really trying to understand how it's, you know, it's looking at all the different parts. It's looking at the organization's ability to respond to things as they begin to fail, even when we cannot fully understand what is failing and what are the consequences of those things that are failing interacting together.
Right. And I think what's fascinating about the Three Mile Island case that he highlights that also is a running theme is that as these events are ongoing, just like in the anecdote at the beginning, the operators are themselves befuddled because, like, if you're sitting in a control panel, you're kind of expecting that when lights are on or switches are in certain places, that that means something, something ordinary, that something is failing, you would expect the alarm to come on. But then the signals, because of the interactions within the system, behaving in ways that the designers didn't expect, then these are translating into signals on the control panel that totally befuddle the operator. And so then, you have other issues where the operators themselves start to get accustomed to certain switches or certain indicators not reading correctly and therefore disregarding these switches. So there's all these interactions which are in a way hidden from the operators themselves or uninterpretable by the operators, who then compound the errors by misinterpreting the situation based on their own experience, pull the wrong switch, something goes wrong or it's added to it, and the operators themselves continue to get befuddled. So there is a cascading impact caused by various interactions that are unpredicted or not predicted by the designers. And also because of the tight coupling, the other dimension, the interactions make the situation worse at a very rapid rate.
So I think one of the other things that I just want to mention, because I think it's like, again, also a very important thread that you see throughout the whole book, and that I think maybe it's an issue that we can discuss more fully in part two, but it's his very critical stance on technology, right? So not only is he telling you up front that he's going to argue that we should definitely abandon some technologies because they're not worth it, basically the risks, or that we're unable to manage them in a way, but also the critiques that he continues to make on like technological fixes, right? Like technology can only fix certain things, like it can only address some of these challenges that we're going to understand throughout the book. He really puts his faith in organizations, in how systems are designed, in how people are able to do their work within organizations instead of just saying, oh, we can fix this with technology, because actually he shows you how that would not really be a fix, right? Like the ability to kind of think on your feet and understand what's going on and come up with like alternative solutions, et cetera.
So maybe we should say something about the kind of technology that is central for the book. Right. I mean, this is just like facts that I got from Wikipedia. But, you know, for those who don't know, Three Mile Island that we're referring to is one of the most significant nuclear power accidents in U.S. history. And he talks that even in the foreword, right, in a way that Perot was already a very established organizational scholar when that happened. And it seems that, you know, that such event, which was widely covered by the media and it is understood to have changed perception about that particular kind of technology, right? Which was in its emergence somehow, at least in the US, from what I understand. It had recently been created, was a new plant, right? And he talks about that. You know, clearly he saw an opportunity to try to understand that. And he talks about that the whole book in a way started by being part, I think, of a committee in which he wrote a short report, and then, of course, trying to bring this idea about coupling and complexity and all of the things we have been hinting at. And as Tom also said, by then expanding across industry, came up with this more robust, bigger framework. But I think it's also interesting to just say, or important to say, that, you know, it changed perception and led to regulation debates and a public debate. And he talks a lot about that later in the book on the role of the public. And how, as Sam was saying, how we deal with technology and the role of citizens in this debate or not. From Wikipedia tells me, the cleanup started in August and ended in December 1993. So even after the book came out, and costed in today's money something like $2 billion. The TMI-1 got back and restarted in 1985, then was retired in 2019. But it's expected to go back in power as part of a deal with Microsoft to power data centers in 2027, right? And I think there is also something, a current debate that we may speak in part two as well on the, from what I understand, nuclear power got a lot of bad reputation, part of this accident and also Fukushima and Chernobyl, of course. But then given the promise that it has for clean energy, quote unquote, there is a renaissance on debates about that, right? So it's a particular kind of technology that is new, perspectively, right? In a particular place that he was trying to understand. And from that engagement, that, you know, event, trying to understand at the conceptual level through the book.
And I'll also mention that Three Mile Island is located only about 15 miles from where I'm currently sitting. When you land at the Harrisburg Airport, you are staring at it. So this story was quite a bit close to home, although I wasn't in Pennsylvania at the time. My son, by the way, goes to Penn State Harrisburg, which is right next to the Harrisburg Airport. Okay, enough about me. The interesting thing that I found in that story was how, just like with the day in the life, about how so many mistakes seem to have been made, But some of it was the result of a whole series of different, seemingly not related, natural failures or challenges or difficulties in the construction of the facility that all conspired together in order to create what could have potentially have been a component failure. And he talks about the differences between, say, a component failure type of an incident in which just, you know, something, one thing in the system goes bad with catastrophic effects that turned into a series of interactions that created this whole thing. And we should also probably mention about his four levels of casualty. I forget the exact term. You know, one of the things that he's concerned about with the high risk, and I think Three Mile Island, based on the location that I just described, he breaks out the different levels of those who would be affected by the accident. There's the first level, who are basically the people on site who would, who would be harmed immediately and directly. He has the second level, which is like those that are on site. And then he has third and fourth level casualties or victims, which would be the surrounding area and the global environment. So you can imagine, like with Chernobyl, when that accident happened, it didn't just harm all of the people who were physically on the plant. It had tremendous impacts for hundreds of miles around because of towns that were wiped out or harmed significantly, and also just the concerns about the global spread of the accident. So, you know, when he's trying to put understand the scope of what harm could be have been done if Three Mile Island really, no kidding, totally blew, it's such a rare, highly unlikely event that it's something that people could try to write off and say, nah, that'll never happen. But with a high-risk technology like nuclear energy, especially given all of the construction problems that were going into these plants, the haste that they were built, the threat of a great catastrophe that affected, you know, would have a major regional, if not global, impact was significant. And that's one of the things I think he was really interested in is, you know, how to recognize the different levels of harm that could come from one of these accidents.
Yes. And I think, I mean, you guys have done a wonderful job of kind of explaining the case that I think in a way like motivated this book. But I think it's also important to say that Perrow's argument is like this is not a one-time thing or a particular plant or, where something like went wrong. But he's actually making the argument that this is a typical nuclear plant, right? So when he asks the question, if this is a typical nuclear plant, why have we only had one of these incidents? And basically his answer is just give it time, right? The technology is young. We've only been doing this for years or something, like give it more time, like more. And he's predicting that more of these kinds of accidents and even worse accidents are going to happen, right? Which I'm no expert, so I have no idea his prediction actually came through, but you know, we can think of some big examples.
I think we can think about the explanatory power a bit later, right? Because I think that's also one of the challenges, right? Because some of the critique, I think, of the book is that the uniqueness of nuclear power and all of that. But I think that in the process, besides what Tom was saying in terms of seeing harm more broadly, right? Well, I think that's also one of the indirect things that he sneaks into the framework that he's trying to push. Of course, nuclear is a great example of that because it can potentially harm also future generations and all that. But it's also the different definitions he lays down on chapter 3, which is kind of the theoretical framework, right? It's a bit interesting that I think that unlike some of the classics that we have read, like Selznick, right, that we go through the entire book to get to the framework that gets induced from the case, is a bit different, maybe because there are so many different cases and he kind of lays down the framework, right? And maybe we can just say a few things about what are the key ideas and what he's talking about when he talks about systems and complexity and so on.
Yes. So I think what we really want to get at with chapter 3, and I think it's the, you know, even if you're not so interested in on nuclear plants or it, you know, if you want to really abstract what I think it's his contribution to organization theory, I think it's beautifully illustrated in his like 2x2, right, of complexity and coupling. So these are the two concepts that he's going to define in this chapter and then use them to kind of map the types of organizations that we see around them, right? So whether they're interactions inside the organization are linear or complex, and we can define that later, and if the coupling is tight or loose coupling, right? So how much room is there for improvisation, basically, within the organization?
Yeah, and also with the tight and loose coupling, it is, how much does a system component failure cascade rapidly, or what is the risk of rapid cascading into other parts of the system? And he has a couple of tables, and I won't summarize the tables, but he has a couple of tables that sort of logically lays out what the implications are for tight and loose coupling systems, and also for complex and linear systems. And all of them are pretty much, you know, common sense. But by putting it together in this 2x2, page 97 was what really draw my attention, was when he took a whole series of different high-risk technologies, ones in which you would anticipate that there would be accidents that could very well have significant harm. And he takes whole classes of these technologies and lays it out in a 2x2 grid, saying that, okay, based on how I surveyed and understand these technologies, here are some that are linear and tightly coupled. Here are some that are linear and loosely coupled. And then the opposite side, complex, tightly coupled, loosely coupled. And kind of goes to say that, all right, those that are in that upper right quadrant of complex and tight, that these are ones in which we would anticipate that serious accidents would occur. They may not occur on a regular basis, but they are inevitable because of the nature of the technologies and the systems, that at some point you're going to have a huge catastrophe in these particular technologies, of which nuclear plant, by the way, is at the furthest extreme in the whole matrix. So of course you can expect that there will be these catastrophes, and you can't just chalk it up to operator error. It's an inherent part of the technology, which I think is not particularly comforting, especially if you're living 15 miles away from one of these plants.
So maybe we can clarify some of the concepts, the important concepts, right? We've mentioned this briefly, I think, in the first few minutes, but he starts this chapter with making a difference between incidents and accidents, right? So incidents, basically, when one unit, one part fails. But accidents is basically when a whole subsystem or different parts within that system fail. And so they kind of produce something that cannot be stopped very easily, right? There's also the concept of how he defines complexity, which is basically the difference between complex and linear interactions. So complex interactions, and I'm quoting him, the connections are not only adjacent serial ones, but can multiply as other parts or units or subsystems are reached. So these are the complex interactions. So these are really the ones that he believes are to make it more prone to be not incidents, but accidents, right? So these like bigger kind of failures. And then he contrasts this with linear interactions, which are, he says, you know, these overwhelmingly predominate in all systems. And this is basically interactions of one component in the design, equipment, procedures, operations, supplies, materials, environment.
And let me also mention his DEPOSE framework, which I think was good for, like, for example, if you're studying an accident, this is almost like a diagnostic framework. It's sort of like an organizing framework of information. And DEPOSE is an acronym that stands for the design, the equipment itself, which may have failed, the procedures, which may have been failed to follow correctly, which, you know, for example, would be likely if indicator lights are giving misleading information or confusing information to the operator. Operator error is the O. S is supplies and materials, whether it's the lack of materials or inadequate for the function. And then the last one is the environment. And one of the things about the Three Mile Island and some of the other technologies that are explored is that the environments can be rather hostile. In the case of a nuclear power plant, you're dealing with extremely hot water that's used for cooling purposes, or the noise, which may be disorienting. And so as you look through and try to make sense of what really happened, that's a good start point to try to organize your thoughts.
The other point that comes to mind hearing all of this is also one of the insights he put forward and takes back again in the postscript in light of research after the book, is the possibility that safety devices can themselves create problems, right? And the whole idea of the, let's say, a dark side of redundancies, which of course is the more mechanical, engineering, technical way in which a lot of solutions and learning takes place. At some point, he of course says that they're not all the same and it's different when you're just adding a redundancy because you don't fully understand what was the real cause. So you just assume given a particular case and you just like change things. So it's just like you add more complexity into the system, right? So it's not that all it's necessarily negative. You know, of course he talks about learning, but he also cautions that sometimes you, when you fail to properly learn, you're just creating more possibilities for interaction between elements that we don't fully understand because you have a new component now there, right? But I think there is also something that comes from, it's like the added value, right? Of one of the things of this framework is that because you're thinking in terms of not just the complexity, but also the coupling and how they interact and have the system level these effects, then you can see that a new part can actually has a negative if you take this broader view on a potential negative outcome.
Yeah, and he came up with plenty of examples across various industries where a safety fix was a Band-Aid, and it was focused on a component without regard for how the resulting interactions, resulting complexity that it induced. So in effect, he accuses the designers of the safety device causing the accident. And that it happens across multiple industries. And that's what I think is really fascinating about the book, is because he covers so many different industries and finds the same patterns, it really adds a lot of rigor, a lot of credibility to his normal accident theory, which is what he calls it.
Maybe we should also say something along the lines of organizational design and structure and what is the context in which all of this is taking place, or how or not to manage these different industries, given his own framework. And this is a bit buried towards the end of the book on when he's talking about this debate about what kind of authority and centralization systems he would have fitting the framework about complexity and coupling, right? And he has this idea that in the linear tight coupling, like dams, I believe, or power grids, you can have centralization, right? That would expect in such situations. In the more complex but loosely coupled situations, like I think we can put universities here, right? I think that's where he talks about, and it's very interesting that he's, you know, draw some parallels there. It's a typical case of centralization, right? Because then the people that are on the coal face and see and can adjust, because there is all this complexity, there are multiple functions being performed at different components, including teachers or professors or researchers, but they can meld and change to fit and adjust to the different situations. Then it has, you know, another quadrant in which it is linear and loosely coupled, that he says that's a matter of choice somehow. So like manufacturing firms and how to centralize or not centralize. But then the important one for the book, which is the one on we have both complexity and tight coupling, like nuclear plants. He says that they have this kind of, how do we call it, dual head, impossible situation, that they both need to be decentralized and centralized, and it should be decentralized to cope with the unplanned interactions that may exist. But at the same time, because of the tight coupling, right, on how doing changing this valve can lead to whatever, something in another room or something like this, create this dilemma that you both need to be able to provide flexibility and autonomy for people that are on the coal face, but at the same time, they lack this overview that not even people that are in the operating rooms have, given what you said, given the, you know, the overloading and the unknown possible interactions, right? So he says that it's kind of another reason that he adds on why we should abandon maybe some of these technologies, because it's even harder to manage and organize around them.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I mean, he mentions military early warning systems in that same quadrant as well, you know, and just imagining putting myself in the place of one of these operators who are, you know, when you centralize something, especially when we're talking about, say, a government, something that's run out of a government, the central control, if that becomes the ordinary way of doing things, it's really, really hard to decentralize in crisis. The tendency is that as the crisis unfolds, it's almost like the gravity just goes back to the central authority, and that the central authority tries to orchestrate. When we know that, the situations when they're on the ground, when the rubber meets the road, it's got to be the one who's there at the control panel having to try to decipher what's actually there, because who else is going to be able, has any chance of being able to tell that the indicators are not correct? Who's going to be the one to be able to tell that there was some design flaw that has created a condition that cannot otherwise be detected unless by somebody, like in one of the cases where the sensor was built to detect the pouring of hot water into a basin, or no, cold water into a basin, but the water that was actually pouring was hot. And therefore, somebody had to actually open the door to the basin and look in there and say, oh, what is all this water doing here? So then how do you, as an organization, try to set those conditions? He also, as a running theme, talks a lot about production pressures. The fact that all of these organizations exist in order to produce something, whether it's power, planes in the air, ships transporting oil, etc., the pressures will tend to be tend to lead you towards centralization, but that runs in the face of the need for those who are actually turning the switches, turning the knobs, having the situational awareness and being prepared to lead through crisis. And it's a hard thing to do organizationally, because if you're so used to centralization, it's awfully tough to let go.
I was just going to add something really short to what Tom said. It's also it's also time, right? This pressure to produce, like, it also leaves very little time to figure out or think about, like, the pressure to kind of respond and not interrupt the production is very high. So that's also one of the things that leads, I mean, he lists that as a characteristic of the kind of tight coupling system that makes the system more prone to system mistakes, system failures.
There is a lot of debate that he brings into the book, right? That now we look back and we see that, you know, I mean, maybe they still exist, but they don't seem so salient to me. And when he's talking about centralization, decentralization dilemma for complex and coupled systems like nuclear plants, he talks about the idea that seems to exist that maybe the solution proposed by some was to have authoritarian army type of system in place. And then he has this whole, I think, almost like a moral series of points that he says that maybe it's really what we want, what is the limits of that, and so on. Well, I don't see this debate happening in this form today, right? I don't think that power plants have been militarized around the world necessarily. But it brought me back to two episodes that we did. One is the one about the nuclear submarine operations, which was an early one in which we covered its characteristics and more particularly its culture. So not so much the structure and the technical parts, but the kind of culture that seems to exist in that unit in the Navy, which is very peculiar and was created in part given the great effort of Admiral Rickover, I believe, which is also mentioned here and so on. But it's mentioned as a sort of authoritarian type of solution, which, from what I remember from that reading that episode, what was unique was exactly the ethos in which sometimes technical expertise could trump formal authority, which, of course, is very unlikely in the military system, right? That an operator can say if the person believes that, you know, doing X or Y is going to compromise the safety, say no, right? So it has that element of decentralization and centralization. But the way he's telling the story, or which seems to suggest the way the debate was one that saw that let's give this to a higher power that is more structured, in which obedience is more taken for granted.
Yeah, now that particular episode is brings a different wrinkle into the centralization and decentralization too, because it is at what level do you centralize? So, for example, on a ship, you know, the captain is everything. you know, that or that's the tradition, is that the captain has been the authoritarian figure. If you centralize at a Navy level where you pull that control back to a distant location and remove that autonomy from that particular ship, then you introduce a different wrinkle. And Perro's examples in the maritime talk about that for barges, where the barge, you know, the people who are on the barge, you know, first off, there are a very small number of people to begin with. And they used to be so many, and they shrank, again, because of production and cost reductions, which added an inability or introduced an inability for a barge to be able to handle or manage itself during crisis. In essence, a commander without much authority basically was incapable of preventing a barge from ramming a bridge or doing something else. And so then in that particular instance, production pressures led to a system that really should not have been so tightly coupled, turning into being tightly coupled with the potential for accidents happening, because maritime accidents do happen. And when they happen, they can be catastrophic. He mentions a lot of oil spills, you know, with a tremendous environmental impact. And the more that we, for example, make an industry safe and productive, what does that do? It adds more incentive for more ships. And more ships means more complexity, more potential for accidents to happen, because then you have to have that more intense coordination across shipping lanes. There's another way in which the added the additions of safety measures or other things that would make things safe also make the system potentially have more items in it, make it more complex, and et cetera.
No, I think I don't know if you guys felt the same thing, but just reading through the book, I think he's continuously critiquing these like pressures of capitalism and corporate greed, right? Like as a big source of the things that make all of these cases worse or more prone to risk. I think another thing that he does, especially in the examples of the chapter 5 aircraft and airways, and then the chapter where he talks about like space or space missions, or chapter 8, is kind of recover and praise a little bit the role that these highly trained pilots, I think in both cases, can have, right? So he talks about the aircraft and airways industry kind of, you know, trying to focus on technological fixes, which do address some of the problems in a way. But he talks about here the example of air traffic control systems as a group of people or an occupation that's really needs to be attributed with solving a lot of the issues that happen in this system that is very, again, tightly coupled and complex. And he uses them to kind of contrast and say, you know, it's not really, we have limits to technological fixes, and it's really giving these people the resources and the structures that they need in order to be able to understand the system and coordinate people to avoid a lot of these accidents. And then he does a critique when he's talking about space missions, about how first they really wanted to treat, or they began treating astronauts as kind of, I think he calls them like chimpanzees or something like that. And how after, you know, the operators kind of realize that they can design everything in a very complex and what they think a good way, and then everything kind of fails. And the only person that can actually address a lot of these failures are the pilots, turn astronauts, that can actually save the missions. So I think that's also something that he's trying to argue throughout the book.
There are just two points I wanted to explore on what you said. One is that while he is very, I think, clear on production pressures, I think that he's trying, and of course he talks about capitalism, but he also always tries to give examples that, you know, there is no perfect socialistic collective country, but he's given an example of USSR, you know, Russia, or any of the other satellites in countries that say that even in that regime there, we can expect similar things, right? Of course, Chernobyl is an example here, because the pressure has a particular configuration, capitalism, but it also exists in other situations. And I think that's what leads him somehow to talk about power towards the end. And I can't remember if it was in the conclusion, the afterword of, you know, the book, which is kind of implicit throughout the book, because I think production pressure is exactly about the extent people can say no, the extent they have autonomy, as you were saying, the extent in which choices are made by the designers of the system or the ones operating or overseeing that. And that also, I think, gets to some of the things that he says, that when he is trying to work out in the afterword, and I'm sure we'll talk about more about this in the second part, on the relationship between his theory and high reliability theory related to Vike and others, when we would expect, you know, these normal accidents to happen or not. And he has an explanation of why in aviation, more particularly commercial aviation, we don't see as many. There's, of course, the role of the operators, but also I think he has things about, you know, that we have a lot of data about the takeoff and landings, and many of the problems tend to happen in landings. So, you know, we can learn from that and observe and have a baseline, right? Much more than nuclear plants. And he has the whole point, which I think brings power into play again, that the elites that are the people that somehow make regulations or influence or make decisions also fly and are directly affected. So they have an inherent interest in the safety of those systems, right? The extent in which there are multiple parties and stakeholders involved. So then there are multiple investigations and, I don't know how to say this, but, you know, a lot of cross-checks that take place. And I don't remember all of the factors, but I think he tries to work out, and he says that, of course, it's preliminary. Why exactly, besides what he already has said on the, you know, the whole idea coupling complexity, the nature of the interest is such, or the nature of the work is such, that would see more possibilities for improvements and more reliability, to use the term of another theory, than in the case that he's particularly focused on.
Yeah, it's also worth mentioning that he also includes discussions about some of the emerging technologies of the time, like recombinant DNA. It's a retrospective look at accidents past, but it is also a way of understanding what's going on in the future. And not just in the technologies, like, you know, we can talk about how aircraft have only gotten so much more complex in the last 30 years. But these emerging technologies like recombinant DNA, which was emerging at the time, the ability to effectively splice genes and create new forms of life, which could very well set the stage for future accidents if let's just call it a bug, gets released accidentally into the environment and starts wreaking havoc with the health systems. So the ability to think ahead and apply the theory forward, I think, also was very helpful.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.